Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
It was spring 2007 in northern Iraq when 6-year-old Saha Salim ran home from school with good news about her progress in school. She hoped to receive a gift her father had promised her. I found myself spinning in the air after a loud boom, Salim, now age 17, told the Associated Press. Salim lost her eyesight, right arm, and an ear in the explosion. The cause was a roadside bomb. Months later, her injuries forced her to leave school after other students criticized her scary face. Salim recently turned to social media to find help. Eventually, her appeal captured the attention of a doctor who offered free medical care. Other Iraqis have also turned to social media. Emotional videos and pictures of people with war wounds and other disabilities have appeared on Facebook and other social media websites. The 2003 invasion of Iraq by a United States-led coalition and the violence that followed left hundreds of thousands of Iraqis wounded. That number increased with the 2014 to 2017 conflict against Islamic State forces. Many Iraqis have lost arms or legs. Their suffering continues long after the violence ended. Poor quality medical services, few specialized doctors or medical centers, and poverty have added to the suffering. Those who cannot get treatment at state-supported hospitals and those who find private doctors too costly are turning to social media to make appeals. Appeals are placed on the personal Facebook pages of patients or on the pages of aid groups and people with tens of thousands of followers. Patients describe their condition and provide contact information. Messages are also published on messaging services like WhatsApp and Viber. Salim and her family remember the explosion that destroyed her life and the years that followed as they struggled financially to get her treated. When I hit the ground, I felt severe pain all over my body. I was bleeding, a pool of blood around me. Everything turned dark, and I lost consciousness, she said. She spoke from her bed at a Baghdad hospital, where doctors have been performing operations to repair her physical appearance for free. Salim's mother, Kuala Umar Hussein, remembers her daughter's shouts when she regained consciousness and realized she had lost her right arm and ear. She woke up screaming, crying, "Mammy, Mammy," Hussein recalled. Then she asked, "Why can't I see? Why is everything dark?" Hospital workers told her it was the bandages covering her eyes and that she would see after they were removed. When that day came, the doctors told her she had lost both eyes. Nearly 2 years later, Salim's family tried to send her back to school, where she was accepted only as a listener in class. But that soon ended as other students and teachers said that her face was difficult to look at. "I was crying day and night," Salim said. The state-supported hospital was only able to perform the necessary treatments to save her life. So Salim's family considered plastic and reconstructive surgery for her at a private hospital, but they were unable to pay the $7,500 for the operations. Then, in late 2017, her mother made an appeal, leaving pictures of Salim and other details in a public group on Viber. Days later, Abbas al-Sahan, one of Iraq's best plastic surgeons, offered to treat her for free. Al-Sahan heads the only state-operated hospital for plastic surgery in Iraq. He said that about 40% of the monthly operations his hospital performs, between 600 to 850, are for victims of bombings and other war-related explosions, as well as for those wounded in military operations. Salim's family feels she is lucky. Not everyone gets the help they need through social media. Iraqi Army Captain Salar al-Jaf was shot in January 2017 during the fight to recapture the city of Mosul from Islamic State. The bullet hit him in the head and left him paralyzed. Since then, he has been treated for the head wound, but not the paralysis. He sold his car and all his possessions to raise money for 3 injections a day, each costing $100, to decrease the pain. He also appeared in a video asking for help. But as of earlier this week, there have been no offers for free treatment. I'm Susan Shand.
A rural area in the western United States has a very unusual school. The school, in the state of Wyoming, has just one student and only one teacher. It is called Notch Peak Elementary. The only student is Corinne Gaby. Her teacher is Lisa Geary. Corinne has no brothers or sisters and lives with her parents on a large ranch in a mountainous area. The school is based on the idea that every child in the U.S. has the right to a public education, no matter where that child lives. But no schools existed in the area where Corinne's family moved. The closest public school is at least a 1.5-hour drive away, and that road is not considered safely passable during the winter. Her parents also decided that teaching her themselves at home was not realistic. So, when Corinne was old enough to start kindergarten, local education officials decided to create Notch Peak Elementary just for her. A new, separate school was not built. Instead, a classroom area was created on the second floor of a horse barn. Large windows keep the room bright, and a wood stove provides heat. Several teachers were considered for this unusual teaching situation. The first lasted a year. The next left after two. Then came Lisa Geary. In 2016, Geary was teaching at a small elementary school in the neighboring state of Colorado. She was excited to hear about the new position and in time was hired. The other teachers had lived in the horse barn. But for Geary, the school district brought a movable home nearby for her to live in. Still, she says her first year was harder than expected. She faced lonely surroundings and severe weather. In an interview, Geary told VOA her relationship with Corinne also got off to a rough start.
It wasn't easy in the beginning. Strong-headed, and it was tough.
Geary said she became discouraged with their lack of progress. At first, she said it seemed like Corinne did not want to be taught.
We really, really struggled that first year, so it wasn't fun for me as a teacher who's waiting for her cup to be filled up.
Corinne agrees that the start of teaching was difficult.
No, we didn't have a relationship right off. It was hard to start.
But over time, Corinne said Geary's teaching methods changed her mind about the unusual one-on-one learning situation.
Now in fifth grade and fourth grade, Miss Geary and I have seen lots of changes in ourselves.
Corinne says Geary's teaching has taught her far more than just what happens in the classroom. She's my everything teacher. Corinne adds, I don't see why any kid would not want any other teacher that's just like her. Geary adds that in every teaching situation, the relationship between teacher and student is very important. She says that her relationship with Corinne is now so close, the two are like family.
It really is a really good fit. We know so much about each other. We can finish each other's sentences sometimes.
Corinne agrees that the two have a much deeper connection than most students and teachers. She describes Geary as the greatest teacher in the galaxy.
Well, she gives me chances, and she really believes in me.
The two also spend a lot of time together outside the classroom. Sometimes Corinne even gets to sleep over at her teacher's house, and they both love taking care of the animals on the ranch. The day usually starts with English-related studies, followed by math before lunch. Additional studies include science, social studies, art, and physical education. Geary says the one-on-one relationship provides the chance for Corinne to learn with a greater depth of knowledge. We go to school from 8 to 3, and I'm often saying, I wish we had more time, she said. However, Geary says she has learned to give Corinne some breaks.
When I started teaching Corinne, I was one-on-one with her all the time, and I'm in her face all the time.
She says she had to learn to pull back a little from the teaching to give Corinne time to regroup. The current situation will likely not continue when Corinne finishes the sixth grade. Geary would have to receive additional training and certifications. She says she sometimes gets sad thinking about this unusual relationship ending. But in the end, she says she just wants to do what is best for Corinne. She believes it will be good for her to get a new perspective in high school and a different teaching environment. But when Geary does leave Notch Peak, no one expects a permanent goodbye. "I will always be connected to Corinne," she says. "Even after I leave the sixth grade, she will always be a part of my life. I'll always be connected." I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. That Constitution, with other amendments added over the years, is still the law of the land. The delegates agreed to start the convention as soon as seven states were represented. On May 25th, they finally began. They gathered in the same room where America's Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The first important decision was choosing a president for the convention. Several of the delegates urged the others to choose George Washington. Washington was the most famous man in America. He had led the forces that won the war for independence from Britain. The delegates agreed. Washington was their choice. George Washington officially opened the convention with a short speech. He thanked the delegates for naming him president of the convention. But, he said, the honor was too great. He asked the delegates to forgive him if he made mistakes. After all, he said, he had never been chairman of a meeting before. With those words, George Washington sat down. Here are two actors playing George Washington and James Madison. They discuss Washington's role in writing the Constitution.
"As for that document, I merely stood back and let the learned gentlemen do their work. I believe I spoke only once in convention, and that to a minor point."
"Well, I believe you do yourself an injustice, sir. As president of the convention, you led the way."
Washington did lead the way, but it was not a straight path. From the beginning, the delegates agreed that they had the right to change their decisions. This was the rule. The convention did not just discuss a proposal, vote on it, and move on to other issues. Any delegate could ask to again discuss any proposal or any decision, and they often did. The same speeches that were made the first time were made again. So days, even weeks, passed between discussions of the same proposal. The delegates also agreed on a rule of secrecy. Guards were placed at the doors of the State House. Newspaper reporters were not allowed inside, and the delegates were not allowed to discuss convention business in public. The secrecy rule led people to think all kinds of things about the convention. This was true especially in Europe. There, most people believed the convention was discussing how America could be ruled by a king. Europeans said a republican government worked in a small country, such as Switzerland, but it would not work, they said, in a land as large as America. At the time of the convention, Thomas Jefferson was serving as America's representative to France. When he learned of the secrecy rule, he was angry. He believed strongly in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. More than 40 years later, James Madison explained the decision behind the secrecy rule. Madison said that if the convention had been open to the public, no delegate would ever have changed his mind after speaking on an issue. To do so would mean he was wrong the first time he spoke, and no delegate would be willing to admit to the public that he had made a mistake. This was Madison's reasoning. If the meetings had been open, he said, the convention would have failed. Another rule helped the delegates speak freely. They used a method of debate known as the Committee of the Whole. It was useful then, and it is still used today in legislatures. Votes taken in the committee are not recorded as final votes. The Committee of the Whole provides a way for people to discuss ideas and vote, but also to change their minds. To have the Philadelphia Convention become a committee of the whole, the delegates needed to elect a chairman of the committee. They chose Nathaniel Gorham, a judge from Massachusetts. Each morning at 10 o'clock, the convention met and declared that it was sitting as a committee of the whole. George Washington then left the president's chair. Nathaniel Gorham took his place. Just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Committee of the Whole declared it was sitting again as a convention. Gorham would step down, Washington would take the chair, and declare that the convention would meet again the next morning. This process was repeated each day. Because of these rules, the story of the Philadelphia Convention would be difficult to understand if we told about events day by day. So we will put the calendar and the clock away and tell how each major issue was debated and settled. On May 29th, the delegates heard what was called the Virginia Plan. This was the plan of government prepared by James Madison and other delegates from Virginia. The Virginia Plan did more than suggest changes to the Articles of Confederation. It was, in fact, a plan for a completely new central government. Immediately, the 33-year-old governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, proposed an amendment. The Virginia Plan, he noted, spoke of a federal union of states. But such a federation would not work, he said. Instead, Randolph suggested that the central government should be a national government. It should contain a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. For a few moments, there was complete silence. Many of the delegates seemed frozen in their chairs. Did they hear correctly? Most of them did not question the idea of a government with three separate branches. Several states already had such a system. But to create a central government that was national and supreme, what did these words mean exactly? What was the difference? The delegates debated the meaning of the words federal, national, and supreme for many days. Both James Madison and a Pennsylvania delegate, Governor Morris, tried to explain. Madison said a federal government acts on states. A national government acts directly on the people. Morris gave this explanation. A federal government is simply an agreement based on the good faith of those involved. A national government has a complete system of operation and its own powers. Governor Morris pointed out that one day the delegates meeting in Philadelphia would be dead. Their children and grandchildren, he said, would stop thinking of themselves as citizens of Pennsylvania or New York or North Carolina. Instead, they would think of themselves as citizens of the United States. Morris said the states had to take second place to a national government with supreme power. Other delegates presented their own plans for discussion. Alexander Hamilton of New York suggested giving the national government almost unlimited powers. Hamilton's ideas were not popular. After Hamilton's five-hour speech, one delegate said, "Hamilton is praised by everybody. He is supported by no one." New Jersey also offered a plan. An actor playing James Madison at a museum in Washington, D.C. says that plan was not popular either.
And William Paterson unveiled the New Jersey plan, calling for one house of equal representation. I knew that Delaware, Rhode Island, and the other small states would never go along with that.
Delegates voted to reject the New Jersey plan. They did not even vote on Hamilton's plan. From that time, all their discussions were about the plan presented by Virginia. For more than 3 months, delegates would debate each part, vote on it, then debate it again. The Virginia Plan formed the basis of discussion at the convention in Philadelphia. In the end, it formed the basis of the United States Constitution.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.